Welcome to episode 38 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. By Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office and celebrating a birthday. Congratulations. We would sing happy birthday, but we'd be subject to a cease and desist and a takedown order from the copyright owners, or the alleged copyright owners, at least. Congratulations.
You. Singing Michael. Would have been the high point of my day, but I'll have to get by with cake and something else.
Well, if we wanted to shrink our audience, we would certainly be singing. Our guest commentator today is Sean Waterman, editor of Politico Pro Cybersecurity, an award-winning journalist who has worked for the BBC, United Press International, and is an expert on counterterrorism and cybersecurity. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you, Stuart.
And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and the record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started. This week in NSA, it turns out, although some of these stories are just slightly off center, to be a fairly productive topic. NSA released its first, second privacy transparency report from Becky Richards, their civil liberties and privacy officer. We're hoping to get her on the show to talk about it, so I won't dwell on it. Edward Snowden documentary, Citizen 4, is out. And Sean, you said you had seen it.
I did. It was very entertaining, actually. And
she's actually a pretty good filmmaker.
She is. Although, as my colleague Dave Pereira said afterwards, it could have done with more menacing music. I think he was being sarcastic. But, it was interesting. There were some amusing moments, as when Mr. Snowden in his Hong Kong hotel room puts a piece of cloth over his head and arms while he's entering his password into the laptop.
Oh, yeah.
To guard, as he put it, against visual collection. And I think we do learn a little bit more about him.
Only what Laura Poitras was obviously in love with him wants to tell.
Indeed, yes, obviously. I think it does leave, you know, it leaves some interesting questions unaddressed. The question I'd like to ask Ed Snowden is, you know, he says that he did what he did in this way rather than the WikiLeaks way because he relied on the reporters to keep, his stuff secret and not to publish anything that might, really damaging to national security or cause lives to be lost. And, at the weekend expressed himself as believing that he would have been more conservative about what was released than they had been. And also,
when
it
you
appears,
pick Glenn Greenwald and say, please protect the United States government to the extent appropriate, you should not be surprised about what you get.
Well, perhaps he shouldn't. But it seems that Mr. Greenwald lost the archives, or lost the password anyway, because Mr. Miranda, you know, his partner was headed back to Rio with another copy from Laura in Berlin when he was stopped at Heathrow. So, I mean, you know, one might want to ask Mr. Snowden how he feels the reporters have done, looking after his stuff.
Yes, I've lost passwords myself or forgotten them, so I'm not surprised. It was nice of them to write it down so that the GCHQ could at least figure out some of the password of the secrets that had been stolen. Now, there's a claim that there's a second NSA whistleblower, and that was part of the film. And did they actually say what secrets they had? They thought they'd gotten from the whistleblower.
So the reference in the film is clearly to this person who provided the intercept with some of these NCTC, National Counterterrorism right. Center documents we saw a few weeks ago. You know, some numbers about the watch list, some procedures about the watch list. Something about the decision chain
For
drone attacks.
I have to say, those strike me as maybe they were secret and maybe they weren't, but we knew there was close to a million people on the watch list, and
we
knew the president was deeply involved in drone strikes because the administration bragged about what a great judicial-style process they had.
Well, indeed, and I mean, I think, you know, reporters have all, even before Edward Snowden, reporters occasionally got hold of classified documents, you know, and, Jeremy Scahill, who appears to be the fellow, you know, the reporter, I mean, you know, has got a relationship with someone, but I'm a long way from saying this is a second Snowden. I mean, he was pretty sui generis, really, wasn't he?
This strikes me as an effort to hype the Snowden archives to suggest there'll be all kinds of good new stuff. This stuff sounds much more anodyne and maybe even quasi-authorized in scope.
Could be. I believe they have done numbers, released numbers on the watch list before.
Okay. Two pieces of knock-on litigation for FISA are in the news as well, and one I promised last time we'd dig into. I'm not sure my view will be shared by our other participants, but it is the fallout from the Clapper litigation against Amnesty International, where the Supreme Court said that Amnesty International didn't have standing to contest the 702 program. When the Solicitor General was asked, well, who would have standing? How would somebody bring a challenge? He said, well, we give notice if we are going into a proceeding and we are using evidence that's derived from or obtained from FISA, then it turned out after he had said that in oral argument and twice the Solicitor General said that in briefs, it turned out that in fact the notice that was being provided to even criminal defendants was pretty constrained, and in particular it appears that they might have told people, yes, you were the subject of a FISA order, but they did not distinguish between ordinary FISA orders where you actually go to the FISA court and get a warrant and these 702 orders, which are the subject of administrative determinations rather than court determinations. And when that emerged, it looks to me at least as though the SG probably overpromised or didn't understand what the National Security Division was doing. I suspect they made assumptions about what the National Security Division was doing and that they were providing 702 notices when, in fact, the National Security Division was only providing ordinary FISA notices and not being clear.
Yeah, he assumed they were following the law, which is, you know, a remarkable assumption.
I beg to differ. I look at that law, and the law says, first, if you're the subject of a regular FISA order, you'll get notice. And then 702 says, and any of these 702 orders will be treated as like FISA, regular FISA orders for purposes of disclosure. That seems to me to invite a very vague notice saying you've been the subject of FISA intercepts, rather than what appears to have been the problem is when 702 was used originally and then later an individualized FISA order was obtained, the prosecutors never said, by the way, we originally picked up information about you under the 702 program, and then later we got a FISA order against you. They just told them about the FISA order. And so the question is, was the individualized FISA order derived from the 702 order, and should they have disclosed both of them to the defendant? I think my bet on this is that the SG missed that, as would many people who read the law or read those notices, and they were doing their best not to over-disclose.
I mean, the premise of the Supreme Court's decision in Clapper, which relied on, in part, on the SG statement that a criminal defendant would have standing to challenge 702. The premise of that is that the person would know that he was subject to surveillance under 702 and not just a regular FISA order. If he gets a notice just saying you were subjected to a regular FISA order, how is he going to challenge 702? He doesn't know he's been subjected to surveillance under it. So I think that's the Supreme Court read the statute in the way that Verrilli did, meaning that you have to be notified that you were surveilled under 702.
Yeah,
and that was an Alito opinion, I think.
For sure, the SG was at best, he was either cute or the National Security Division let him be cute, especially as the reply brief came along, where he basically came very close to saying, yes, if we get 702, if we use 702 information, we will disclose that fact. And that is hard to square with the practice up to that point. And what we've seen now afterwards is, it seems to me, Verrilli is basically saying, okay, maybe I misled the court, but let's make what I said true by changing Justice Department practice. They are struggling to explain how they came to tell the Supreme Court what they told them, and their latest theory, if I understand it, is the one I described earlier, that it's not if we get a regular FISA order based on what we learned from 702, that regular FISA order is not derived from 702, or at least the evidence we're putting forward is not derived from it, and we're only required to disclose the
isn't that
the
contrary
FISA
to the way prosecutors and courts interpret the word derived when it comes to Title III surveillance or something else in the whole doctrine of the fruit of the poisonous tree? I mean, the statute talks about information obtained or derived. So derived clearly means something other than just obtained from. And it's a broader term. So I think this notion that derived in the 702 context has a narrower meaning from what it means in every other context is a stretch.
I agree with you on that. I actually think it's kind of hard to say this wasn't derived from, although as the Justice Department has started to focus on, and the reason this is a hot topic now, is they've started to say, well, gee, if derived from has this really broad meaning, we have to go look at all the other proceedings that might use evidence derived from 702. And so this has started to drag in the Treasury Department, which has all of these specially designated nationals who are designated in, you know, kind of quasi, well, they're designated individually on the basis of classified information, and they rarely get much notice of what was used against them. But in theory, you can go in and challenge that. Now the fear on the part of Treasury is they're going to have to start telling all of these foreign terrorists and Putin kleptocratic accomplices that they were the subject of 702, which is probably not something that they want to do. And my understanding is that's the current fight, is now that the Justice Department has decided to adopt a broad reading of derived, they are starting to impose it on
I'm surprised
agencies.
DOJ isn't running up to the Hill to seek an amendment, or maybe they are, because, you know, I think their requirement to disclose this stuff is in keeping with the plain language of the statute. You know, it's not limited to disclosure in criminal proceedings. It talks about any use of information obtained or derived from 702 in any sort of proceeding in a court or before any department or agency. So, you know, an OFAC proceeding certainly seems to fit that broad definition. So it will have, I think, detrimental consequences, but the law is the law.
And, yeah. You know, it creates an absurd result, too, that in an OFAC proceeding involving one of these specially designated nationals, 99 times out of 100, if not 100 out of 100, they're foreigners as to whom the Fourth Amendment doesn't even apply.
Yeah.
And yet they would have to be given notice in this way. So I agree. I think that either the interpretation by the department's got to change or the statute itself's got to change.
I once said about another Justice Department policy that they walk with a limp, so everybody else has to have a stone in their shoe, too. This may be one where the Justice Department clearly screwed up, regardless of who you think did the screwing up. It would be ironic if Treasury ends up paying the price for that.
You know, I wonder if, you know, it's hard to say, having not been in the prep that the SG went through for this argument, but I wonder if the SG interpreted the statute to require 702 specific notice, NSD interpreted it the other way, the SG asked if they were complying with the statute, NSD said yes, and they both walked away from the conversation thinking different things.
Quite possibly, or they read it and they made just a few tweaks in the editing of the brief, or at least the main brief. They didn't get the same tweak opportunity with the reply brief, which is a little more damaging. And didn't make a big deal of why they were making the edits or suggesting the edits. So yes, I suspect that this is a situation where there was just a failure of communication, maybe in the press of getting ready for the oral argument and filing the reply brief, because you don't have much time for those. Anyway, so it will be an interesting sort of unanticipated consequence of all of this. And the second thing that piece of litigation that I thought was pretty interesting and also unintended, maybe even a kind of punishment for doing the right thing, is Judge Pauly's opinion in the ACLU against FBI FOIA litigation. Judge Pauly, as you remember, upheld the constitutionality of 215 in a very thoughtful and detailed rebuttal of Judge Leon's opinion. And in this case, the ACLU said, we'd like to see any documents that talk about bulk collection of any kind under 215. The FBI said, excuse me, we aren't even going to tell you whether we have documents that are responsive to that, a kind of Glomar response where you say, if I tell you I have documents, they go beyond 215, then you'll know we have other programs, and that would be bad. If we tell you we have no documents beyond 215, that will be bad because it will tell terrorists they don't have anything to worry about from 215 other than this program. And the judge bought that. What he didn't buy was the statements about the difficulty of providing further information on FISA court opinions, where he basically said, look, the government's been all over the map. Back in 2007, you said we can't release this under FOIA because the courts are in charge of it. Then later you said, oh, no, the courts aren't in charge of it. You can always get FOIA. And then you told us we couldn't you couldn't possibly redact these and produce useful information. And yet now that we've seen the declassified versions of some of these letters, it's obvious that you could have released some of the more damaging passages without exposing any classified information. And so he basically said, I just don't trust the government anymore. I'm going to review all of these things myself, which, coming from a judge who obviously is not otherwise in tune with the ACLU's pitch, I thought was pretty troubling. And so one more situation where the Justice Department is taking on water from the history of trying to resolve these things without disclosing more than they have to.
And up to now, Judge Pauly's been perhaps the Justice Department's best friend on the bench, so I don't think they want to lose him.
No, that's right. So if you've lost Judge Pauly, well, you've lost America.
Maybe on a future podcast when we don't have any, we need time to fill, I'll tell a story. My first ever hearing as a prosecutor was in Judge Pauly's courtroom, and I got so flustered cross-examining witness I cursed, but that'll be a story for another time.
That's exciting.
He was very gracious and did not hold me in contempt.
Yeah, I'll also tell you the story of the time I took a live cell phone into a Supreme Court argument and argued the whole case with it sitting there waiting to go off. More national security litigation, and this involves Twitter and canaries, and not the kind of twittering that you might think a canary does. Michael, can you?
Twitter has filed suit in federal court for a declaratory judgment holding that the government's restrictions on what communications companies can say about the sorts of national security orders they've received for information violates the First Amendment because it's a prior restraint. You'll recall that the government has now allowed companies to disclose more information than they have in the past about, broad numbers, 0 to 999 NSLs in a six-month period, or, a certain tranche of other types of orders. And most companies have gone along with that now grudgingly. But Twitter has now filed suit saying that's a First Amendment violation, and an unnamed telecom company has appealed a restriction in the Ninth Circuit now, also making the same sort of First Amendment argument. And the Ninth Circuit apparently expressed some skepticism about the government's position. So it'll be interesting to see what happens out there. I'd be surprised if the government doesn't win these cases because, there have long been restrictions on what somebody can say about receiving a wiretap order or a search warrant, things like that. So I wouldn't hold out hope for the companies, but it will be interesting to see what the Ninth Circuit does.
I think the more interesting argument here is can they persuade the courts that they have a First Amendment right to say we've received zero orders? You'd think, they're not under a court order not to speak. They're saying something that is true. Why would there be a problem with that? But of course, the purpose of doing that is not not necessarily to disclose.
I think you're right. That's a much more interesting argument. I think there the government's going to have a much tougher burden. But it seems inevitable that Twitter's going to get an order at some point if it hasn't already.
And as you remember from a past podcast, Apple's canary did die, and they had to drop that decision from that phrase from their report. Do you think that there's any basis for saying that they don't have a First Amendment right at Twitter to say we've never received an order?
I don't see how the fact case can be true.
The which case?
The fact case. I don't see how.
How can you be enjoined from?
No. How can Twitter not have received an order? I mean, surely they.
Well, a lot of their stuff is public. Right. You can buy the feed and you can look at the feed. So a lot of what the government wants from them is IP addresses, I believe, and subscriber information, which you could get through a variety of means. But I agree with you. It's a little odd that they've received none, given how important they are as a communications medium, and they do have direct messaging.
I'm sorry. Are they saying they've received none then? I mean, they're not allowed to, right?
That's the
point.
I think they're suing to be able to put zero down as an option. Presumably they wouldn't do that if they didn't think that it would redound to their credit in the long run.
But I mean, I think in terms of a public relations strategy, you know, it's always good to try and sue the Justice Department.
Oh, right. Clearly, this is displacement behavior, you know, where this is where two roosters are put in a small pen, and instead of attacking each other, they really scratch at the dirt. And so suing the Justice Department over something that is a little remote from actual national security impact allows you to say, yeah, we hate those guys too, without necessarily exposing you to attacks that you're unpatriotic or are going to get people killed. Okay, so speaking of getting people killed, Europol is saying that the Internet of Things is going to get us killed, and the Federal Drug Administration seems to be taking that pretty seriously. Jason, did you take a close look at what the FDA has done?
Yeah, and I have to say this is going to completely change my relationship with my refrigerator and my toaster. so Europol is...
Which was killing you slowly.
Exactly. Now it's going to kill me all in one fell swoop. So they will be the advanced team for our robot overlords in the future. So Europol is joining in with others in predicting an Internet of Things connected murder at some point in the next year. So, you know, good luck not being that person. And what Europol is doing is calling on law enforcement throughout Europe to get ready to be able to investigate and prosecute crimes committed by hacking Internet-connected devices like automobiles, wearable devices, body implants, other devices connected as part of the Internet of Things. And specifically, Europol has advised that extortion or blackmail, use of ransomware to take control of cars and smart homes and smart cars could result in physical injury or worse, and that law enforcement needs to be prepared to pursue that. On this side of the pond, the FDA is issuing recommendations to manufacturers of medical devices to be prepared to manage and have systems in place to manage cybersecurity risks associated with those devices. And basically what the FDA is telling manufacturers, you've got to build in cybersecurity from the very beginning as opposed to patching it on at the end. And they're requiring manufacturers to consider cyber risks as part of the suite of other risks that they consider during the design development process. And as part of the pre-market submission of devices for FDA approval, manufacturers are going to be required to account for the cybersecurity risks that they considered in the design and manufacture, to document the steps taken to address those risks. And they're going to have to demonstrate to the FDA that they've got plans for patching software when vulnerabilities are identified. And I think it reflects the fact that, you know, we talk a lot about data breaches and cyber attacks that result in loss of credit cards and identity theft. This is, of course, cyber attacks that could actually kill you or certainly result in serious injury or threat to your home or threat to your vehicle or threat to your health. And, you know, I read in one of the articles about this made reference to the fact that Dick Cheney, when he was the vice president, had been told by the manufacturer of his pacemaker to disable the wireless feature on the pacemaker so that it couldn't be hacked as part of an assassination attempt, which for those of you who watch Homeland makes the pacemaker related assassination of the vice presidency's to Homeland a little less hokey than I thought it was at the time. So the message to device manufacturers, you got to harden security in your devices from the very beginning. But, you know, it's also important for healthcare providers and hospitals to have to make sure that cybersecurity is a big focus of their efforts, too. They're the ones who are collecting and transmitting and utilizing health information and utilizing these devices, and the liability risks are tremendous. And all of the retailers and other kinds of companies that we talk about every week who have need to consider their cybersecurity insurance needs and their risk pales by comparison to the risks and liability that healthcare companies face.
And, you know, just the possibility, if an attack is possible, you know, every time somebody dies from then on who's got one of those devices installed, there's at least some possibility that they were offed by a hacker, which means that you could be sued every time somebody dies, which is probably not a good position to be in if you're a medical device manufacturer.
When I was at DOJ, I oversaw cybercrime and violent crime, and the two had nothing in common with each other, but now apparently they're going to meet in the middle.
At last, right. I have to say, I looked at that, and it was maybe three pages of substantive guidance, maybe two. You kind of thought, well, I'm glad you're doing it, but is this all you've got to say? It was pretty vague.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I mean, the, you know, the New York Department of Financial Services regulations on Bitcoin are the Encyclopedia Britannica compared to this, and this is obviously much more important.
And should they send a copy over to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration? Because you would have thought that by now somebody would have put out a set of standards for self-driving cars that looked at least as detailed as this.
Speaking of
machines that could kill you.
Exactly.
I didn't see a lot of coverage of that. Is the press just not that interested?
Of the FDA?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hypothetical, right? And I mean, you know, I mean, it's definitely doable. I saw Barnaby Jack do it at Hacker Halted in Miami. You know, you open the vial on the controller on the insulin pump.
I saw that same thing. It's pretty troubling.
But I mean, you know, it remains a theoretical possibility at this point.
And what will happen, I think the way it will manifest itself initially is a hacker will gain control of a device and they will hold the hospital or the manufacturer for ransom and threaten to utilize the
That's
the
easier access. Than killing people.
Yeah, I think
maybe safer.
This is all about money. It's always about money. And so this is just another way for a hacker to exert leverage over a hacking victim.
All right. Well, I called up Troels Ørting, the Europol guy, who said, there's going to be murders, and we're going to get him on the show in a couple of weeks.
That's
so
great.
That'll be fun.
You can tell me what refrigerator is safe to buy.
none of them are safe.
Exactly. The smaller, the better, I think. Okay. So the U.S. continues to sort of slide left on surveillance, but boy, the pendulum swings the other way south in the southern hemisphere. First, New Zealand kicks Kim.com and Glenn Greenwald in the butt, and then Australia has passed a very aggressive, or at least purportedly aggressive, you can't entirely believe the alarmist press, a set of surveillance rules. Michael, can you tell us how aggressive
Yeah, but before that,
is?
I'll just note another marker of the fact that here in the U.S. we're definitely in the post 9/11 era is the fact that they just reached the top height of a new building in New York, which is taller than World Trade Center 1, and it's a residential building on Park Avenue. And remember, in the 9/11, just after 9/11, people said no one will ever want to live in a tall building again. Well, this is now 96 stories, taller than the Empire State Building, taller than one World Trade Center if you take that spire off. The apartments are so expensive, though, that it's going to be inhabited probably only by Russian oligarchs, so maybe Americans still are scared to live that high, or at least most can't afford to. But, you know, in Australia, the bill you're talking about purportedly allows the government to surveil an unlimited number of computers with a single warrant. Moreover, the, you know, warrants there don't have to be issued by a court. They're issued by a government minister. So I think it is pretty broad. Whether it's applied that broadly remains to be seen. The other aspect of it that Sean should be mindful of, if he ever travels to Australia, is that it provides for criminal punishment up to 10 years in prison for a whistleblower or a reporter who discloses national security information recklessly.
Well, Australia comes out of the UK Official Secrets Act tradition, which is considerably less friendly to the press, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, when I was coming up, I'm not sure if this still pertains, but everything was secret. That was the default position. Mm-hmm. If the government didn't actually publish it, it was an official secret.
Wow.
But I mean, they also didn't even acknowledge the existence of the security services officially until the mid-90s. So, you know, one of the reasons I live here now, Stuart.
That's right, because it's a much more target-rich environment.
You know, I think it should be said, too, that in both the UK and Australia, there's a very present fear of terrorism because of what's going on with the Islamic State. You know, there's a fear that Australians and British citizens have traveled to fight with ISIS slash ISIL slash Islamic State, and that they're going to bring come home and commit acts of terrorism. And there have been arrests in both countries. So I think that's partly what's feeding the climate of fear in those countries.
Yeah, I think they, the Australian authorities said that they had broken up an ISIS-inspired plot to randomly behead Australians, which certainly would get your attention.
Yeah, I mean, it's I believe there were some arrests this morning, actually, in the UK. But, yeah, there's certainly a great concern. And there's also a sort of a debate about how you deal with these fellows when they come home. You know, I mean, it's been suggested that they're not, that they shouldn't be allowed to come home. And I mean, I'm not sure whether that's, you know, entirely a good idea.
Well, maybe a 99-story building in Guantanamo could be built.
Well, apparently a lot of them come back sort of rather disillusioned, actually.
Yeah, and you can understand how that would be. But yeah, my memory is there was also some chilling pictures of some 11-year-old Aussie kid holding up a beheaded head and saying, "Yeah, go Islam," or sort of worse.
That's. I mean, and you know, I mean, clearly there are some disturbed individuals involved, but. But it's as a policy response, I think there's a it's probably outside of the scope of this podcast, but you know, it's an interesting question. What do you do with these guys when they come home? You know, because obviously there is a threat, and at the same time, you know, if you intern them or whatever, you may not, that may not necessarily be the way to deal with it.
Right. Well, the Saudis have worked hard on getting, you know, they have a lot of people coming back because it's just across the border, and they have tried to create a detox program for them that has had some spectacular failures, but apparently a fair amount of success.
It's getting the data that's always the trouble with that place.
Yes, that's right. You sort of expect them to talk about their successes and not literally bury their failures. Okay, well, we talked a little bit about what Twitter's First Amendment rights are. Turns out First Amendment is a profoundly local ordinance, because the United States is the only government that can't tell Twitter or Google what not to say. I think we should mark this moment. I'm going to say something nice about the European Commission. This is rare, but the Italian presidency and the European Commission put out a short paper about the right to be forgotten, saying, you know, there's this free expression thing, and maybe just handing these decisions over to a private entity that lives in fear of being fined for what they don't take down is not the best way to protect free expression, and maybe we ought to sit down and think about how this thing actually works in practice, which I thought was very useful in the debate, since apparently the U.S. government is just going to let U.S. companies be censored in this way, even if Americans are using some of these search engines and not being told about facts that one government or another doesn't think are appropriate. Now, has Politico had anything taken down yet, as far as you know?
No, not as far as I know.
Yeah.
We mainly have a U.S. audience, I suspect, although, I mean, it obviously it's available worldwide, but I think that probably most of our audience is here in the United States.
Yeah, although it's not clear that Americans cannot ask for takedowns. They would have to ask google.co.uk to take down links to Politico, but they, some of the links to the New York Times have been taken down. In fact, I sort of take it personally. You know, how much dirt are you really digging if nobody is?
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, it is a worrying, it is a worrisome trend, and it's, you know, as we, I mean, unfortunately, or perhaps otherwise, it does resonate with the public, you know, as we've seen in the UK with the hacked off campaigns, right. This feeling that, that, you know, basically the media is a sort of big bully, mm-hmm. and writes what it likes and says what it wants. And, you know, so, it is, I mean, as a fan of the First Amendment, it is very worrisome.
Well, the other interesting and useful thing that the Italian presidency said is, and, you know, ordinarily you'd expect somebody who's a data processor like the New York Times or Politico to know what's been taken down and have an opportunity to contest the decision to take it down. And we don't see anything of that sort. There is some notice, but it's not required. It's just kind of by the grace of Google and Microsoft and Yahoo. So telling the publisher, by the way, we're taking down some of your links is, I would have thought, the very first thing that ought to happen. But, you know, the data protection guys say, well, that'll just encourage exposure of the very facts that ought to be suppressed. So, you know, when you're in a censor, when you're a censor, that your work is never done.
that is true. The memory hole is bottomless, right?
Yeah. So you had promised to talk to us a little bit, and I asked Jason to look at it as well, at this FBI statement about how they were able to break into the Silk Road website and figure out who was the owner of it, and to get hold of, is it Ross Ulbricht?
William Ulbricht, yes.
And it does sound a little as though the FBI's first story about how they got access to this is coming apart. And if I remember, the story was essentially that there was a mistake in the CAPTCHA, which is that really annoying thing where you're supposed to guess what the words are and type them in regular type, and apparently it was leaking its real IP address, according to the FBI, and they only had to go there like any other citizen could to see what the IP address was. But there have been some techies and Ulbricht's lawyers challenging that and making much in the press about how they believe the FBI is not telling the truth. Now, Jason, did you look at that more closely, or did I get that about right?
No, you got that about right. I mean, I think there are a number of people in the technical community, much more technically proficient than me, who have said that it's not possible for the FBI, for the CAPTCHA on the logon page, to have leaked the real IP address, because what it would have leaked is an IP address of a Tor node. It wouldn't have been an IP address that would have been in the clear. And so what some have speculated is that that the FBI was telling the truth to the extent that it did it through the login page, but that the real story is that they actually entered commands to require to get the IP address out. That basically it was essentially a hack.
Oh, so they got a buffer overflow of some sort, so they it was possible to log in and then add a bunch of commands on your login, and they would be run by the machine. Yeah, that does sound possible. I don't know. Did you look at that more closely, Sean?
Well, we sort of looked at the legal piece of it, really. You know, the FBI submitted a new filing at the end of last week where they basically, I guess, clarified or tried to clarify their original submission, also stated categorically that the NSA wasn't involved. There are some questions about it, and, you know, it puts the defendant in a bit of a double bind, because you know, he has to declare a privacy interest in the server in Iceland, and I mean that
which is by way of saying he owns it.
Well, that he owns it. That might indeed that now you're allowed to do that apparently in pre-trial proceedings without it being introduced as evidence, but then it can also be used to impeach you if you testify in your own defense. So it does put him in a bit of a tricky situation. to my way of thinking, the most interesting thing about all this is that the FBI have said, apparently, you know, well, even if we did that, it's not illegal. You know, we're doing it. It's outside of the
United States.
Of the United States, so we're not breaking U.S. law.
I mean, I think they're right as a matter of law, and I think that tactically it's a clever position to take, because whatever the tactic that the FBI used, if it was something a little more complicated than what they've described in the affidavit, they want to be able to do it again.
Right.
And to the extent that they describe the tactic in some level of detail, it will be something that people can go to school on and protect themselves from. And as a legal matter, to the extent that this was a foreign server in a foreign territory searched by foreign officials, not acting as agents of or in a joint venture with the United States, then legally the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. And even if the government did use tactics they couldn't use if the server was located in New York City, the evidence would still come in. So they get the benefit of admissibility of the evidence without having to admit in any level of detail with what the tactics they used. And you know, although it's natural to focus on this as a function of the sort of the digital world, it happens in the real world too. As I was thinking about this morning, I was thinking about a case I had in Baltimore against a gang where we installed cameras and bugs in the gang's headquarters. And we came up with what I think was a pretty clever way to get in, and we had to dance around the question of how we got in our pleadings and in all of our presentations to the court. It wasn't relevant to the question of whether the entry was lawful and our presence there was lawful. But the defendants really wanted to know how we got in, not because it had anything to do with admissibility, but because they wanted to be able to stop that technique. And so if anytime you find something, any good law enforcement technique has a expiration date on it, you just want to extend it as long as you possibly can.
So here's my question. The last time we did this, the FBI did this, breaking into a hacker's computer in Russia, the Russians indicted us. So,
yeah,
do we
still pending arrest warrant for that agent? If
right.
I recall correctly.
What does the FBI have to fear from Iceland?
Well, in this case, Iceland was acting in concert with with the FBI, and there appears to be a more cooperative relationship. So, I don't think they have anything to fear from Iceland. I don't think they would have tried this if it was Russia.
Right. Okay, let me turn now to the most, I'm not sure whether this is the dumbest press story or the dumbest judicial opinion of the month. It's certainly, as a combination, has produced more anxiety and a greater hype than it possibly deserved, which is the claim that a Navy investigator surveilled an entire state, the state of Washington, and therefore that a guy who possessed child porn ought to go free because of the shocking behavior of the Navy investigator. Michael, I know you looked at this, and the thing that always puzzled me when they said that they surveilled the entire state, I said, what, they broke into every computer in Washington? And the real story turns out to be a whole lot less interesting and maybe less of a celebrity.
In part. I mean, I think it's fair to say it's a dumb opinion, but a correct decision. And by that I mean the opinion is full of hyperventilating, as you described, about this Navy investigator surveilling every computer in the state of Washington, when in fact all he was doing was using Nutella to see who was openly sharing with the public child pornography.
Now, I'm sure that most of we got all these government officials in our audience, so and innocent journalists, so they probably don't know what Nutella is. Could you give us 1 minute?
I can give you less than that. It's basically a file sharing program that allows people to share files if they're in the network. Yeah, exactly. But for any other types of files, and it's very common, widely available, widely used, including unfortunately by child pornographers. And that's partly how you get a single piece of child pornography viewed by thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. It's staggering. So the defendant in this case was certainly the least sympathetic defendant possible, at least to me. But the problem is that the agent was providing direct assistance to civilian law enforcement because he identified someone sharing child pornography publicly. That person was not a member of the military. And the investigator then passed on that information to civilian law enforcement, which investigated and indicted the guy. And what the Ninth Circuit said was this violates the Posse Comitatus Act, or more precisely, regulations issued which restrict the Navy from providing direct assistance to civilian law enforcement. So I think that was the correct result. I mean, the government took, I think, the rather startling opinion that, or position that, the agent wasn't providing direct assistance to civilian law enforcement because he was just trying to see if anyone in the military was sharing child pornography. He didn't have anybody in mind in the military, and, you know, the person he identified was not in the military. And, you know, that position sweeps so broadly, it would allow Defense Department investigators to do anything on the theory that, well, hey, we might have come across somebody in the military doing this.
Well, let me try defending the government on this one. It's not clear if the only tool you have is to get onto Nutella and look at the IP addresses. It's not clear that there's some easier way to find the military users than to say I'm gonna pick areas where the military is common and then look to see. And when I get an IP address, then I'll figure out who has the IP address. And if he's military, I've got jurisdiction. How else would you find people who are in the military and sharing jobs?
You leave it to civilian law enforcement. I mean, the percentage of military users of Nutella who are sharing child pornography is probably, you know, infinitesimally small compared to the overall civilian population. So I think that theory, when this investigator had no particular person in mind, didn't even have an inkling that there was a military ring of people sharing this that was, you know, doing this broadly, at least not, that wasn't apparent from the opinion. So I think it was just way out of line. And apparently this was a common tactic by at least the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. And the court was so troubled by the government's litigation position, as well as the fact that this was a common occurrence, that it excluded the evidence. And normally the exclusionary rule doesn't apply to violations of posse comitatus. And that generated one dissent, at least a concurrence on the judicial decision about posse comitatus, but dissenting from the exclusionary rule. And that, you know, letting a child pornographer go free is not something courts typically do very much. But to come back to the rhetoric of the decision, you know, I don't think that the opinion mentions at all that, you know, this really wasn't a Fourth Amendment search, because you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy in what you share publicly. And that's what the opinion suggested.
That's why they kept saying surveillance and surveil, because they actually couldn't say search. So it was basically saying you're looking at something that's public, and we're creeped out because we're judges and
yeah. So you know, there wasn't a Fourth Amendment violation, but that's not what the decision involved. It involved the Posse Comitatus Act, and there I think the court got it right. It's just the rhetoric was overblown.
So I will only offer this. Posse Comitatus comes up almost entirely in intra-governmental disputes about what DOD is going to do, and DOD lawyers were constantly coming in various contexts and saying, oh, we'd love to help you, but Posse Comitatus. And I used to joke that Posse Comitatus was Latin for we don't wanna. Okay. So last topic that I wanted to cover. I don't know. Any other topics you guys want to get into? So I've been occasionally critical of government regulation, but I have to say, this is the feel-good regulatory decision of the month. The FCC has charged Marriott $600,000 for blocking other people's Wi-Fi, people who were trying to get around the $1,000 a conference charges that Marriott was putting out, because they said, well, I can actually have faster Wi-Fi if I just set up a little Wi-Fi point and enable my friends to get out on the wireless network. And the Marriott hotels had found a technical way to make that impossible. impossible to do. And the FCC said, no, the airwaves are for everybody. You can't do this. And having been victimized by bad Wi-Fi that where you have no choice but to use it and to pay, I felt pretty good about this. My guess is everybody on this podcast has.
Well, we just had it on our partners retreat this weekend, which was held at a Marriott. And the price for the regular Wi-Fi was $12.95, and if you wanted fast Wi-Fi, it was something more than that. I don't know, because the firm only paid for us to get the slow Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so we should have said, excuse me, you have 500 lawyers here at the Marriott. Have you seen this decision?
Okay. I found it really offensive that they use security as their excuse as well.
Yeah. Well, the last session we did describe the fact that somebody offering the F-Secure in London offering free Wi-Fi had said, by the way, you have to accept our terms and conditions, which included a Herod clause in which you were giving up your firstborn in order to get this free Wi-Fi. So you can see that there are issues with that, but my guess is that that was not really their motivation.
I don't think so either.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jason. Jason Weinstein, Michael Vadas, Sean Waterman. That was just a lot of fun. Before we sign off, we like to give people an opportunity to plug their upcoming speeches, books, articles, events. Sean, why don't we start with you? You got anything you want to plug?
Well, I'll just talk about our morning newsletter, Morning Cybersecurity, which is your essential...
Is that spelled with a U? M-O-U-R-N?
It's your essential, start the day read. It's available both to subscribers and a little later in the day for free. And you can sign up at politico.com/morningcybersecurity.
We will do that. That's great. And then we'll start using items in the podcast. We'll bring you back if we have things that only you covered. We'll want you back. Jason, any speeches coming up?
So one thing, apropos to our discussion about the Internet of Things, Steptoe is having a webinar on legal liability from vehicle cyber attacks and other technology upgrades in vehicles that we are calling Car Hacked. And it's October 21st at noon. And for more information or to sign up, go to steptoe.com.
Very good. No speeches, Michael? Just athletic events coming up. So I'll be rowing in the head of the Charles Regatta this weekend up in Cambridge, Mass.
Oh, that birthday really got to you, didn't it?
I've been doing this for a while, but you know you're getting old when you're in the senior masters event, which is where the boat's got to average 50 or older.
Oh, yeah, okay. So now you can at least help them achieve their average by adding a year. That's great. Okay, and I am going to be speaking at the Cybersecurity Summit in Minneapolis on the 21st, so the same time you're doing the Auto Hacked event. I think that's probably my next event. And then I am going to Dublin for the Founders Conference in early November, which should be entertaining, although I have to fly back quickly to give a speech in Pittsburgh at the Zittrain institution, which is actually Jonathan Zittrain's parents who are setting it up. So, and before I go, I guess I really have to do this. We have been telling people that we'd like to get feedback. You can send your emails with interview candidates, topics, feedback to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com, and you can leave a message at 202-862-5785. I have to tell you, we got our some feedback that I thought was delightful from a fellow named Dick Mills, who himself is a blogger, and he sent us an advanced copy of his blog, and I'll read just a bit of it. Regular readers know that I lean toward the libertarian side of politics, and that I think Edward Snowden is a hero. I have found an anti-hero, Mr. Stuart Baker. Mr. Baker, formerly of NSA and DHS and now a private practice lawyer, has views the opposite of mine on many issues. I think of him as the great Satan, the beast. And he has a podcast called the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast. I started following this because I'm interested in the issue. I found Mr. Baker's attitude and that of many of his guests breathtaking. They are contemptuous of privacy advocates and foreign governments. He's proof of why the government should never be trusted. If people in government are as contemptuous of privacy as he is, we can only expect they will strive to circumvent and subvert any restrictions the public wishes to place on them. On the other hand, Mr. Baker, his partners, and his guests are very well informed about what is going on beyond the headlines. They're very pragmatic about what is likely to happen and how debates are likely to pan out. I've come to respect their knowledge and insight greatly. After listening to Mr. Baker and after critical thinking, I conclude that he's correct on some of these issues and that I should change my opinions. I still think of him as the great Satan, but a Satan who is reasoned and correct pretty often. So I can't imagine a better bit of feedback. And so thank you, Dick Mills, for your feedback. And that's a standard. We have said that entertaining abuse will be played or read on the air if it's particularly entertaining. And this, I thought, was really hit the sweet spot for what we're hoping to do with the
podcast. Are you going to put the great Satan on your firm bio? You know, maybe replace what it says now about being the most technology savvy lawyer in Washington. I think the great Satan would be a nice, at least, accompaniment.
I you know, that's right. I'm the most techno-literate and satanic lawyer around. I think the second is a harder club to crash.
More competition for
yeah,
that
exactly. Okay, so this is the great Satan signing off. This has been episode 38 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week when we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.